This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Environmental Studies, one of the New Books Network podcasts. My name is David Fauser. Today I am joined by Andre Magnan, Associate Professor in Sociology and Social Studies at the University of Regina. His book is When Wheat Was King, The Rise and Fall of the Canada-UK Grain Trade, published by University of British Columbia Press in 2016. Dr. Magnan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Wonderful. Let's start by talking about your own personal background and your disciplinary training, and then how you came to this particular project.
Sure. Originally, in my undergraduate work, I studied biochemistry of all things. So not a social science, but I was at that time interested in the natural sciences. And it was towards the end of my undergrad degree in biochemistry that I got interested in the topic of genetically modified crops and sort of the controversy that was emerging around those at the time. This was in the late 1990s. That's what sort of sparked my interest in the whole social side of this emerging technology, the kind of social and political controversy around these new crops. And that's what inspired me to pursue a degree in sociology for my master's later on my PhD.
And is this research that you began as a graduate student, or did you pick it up later?
During my grad studies, during my master's studies, I studied the introduction of GM crops to the prairie region of Canada, Saskatchewan specifically, my home province. And so that was sort of a study of how these crops got introduced and what some of the implications might be for farmers and for the agricultural industry. And then with my PhD studies, I took that a little bit further in looking at, first of all, the attempt to introduce genetically modified wheat to the Canadian prairies, which ultimately failed. So it was an interesting example of a corporation, in this case Monsanto, developing a new technology, a new GM crop, this time for wheat, actually being prevented from introducing that crop to commercial production because basically of farmer opposition. In fact, one of the big reasons why GM wheat was not adopted was because the Canadian Wheat Board, a very important institution in the history of the prairie wheat economy, was opposed to introducing this crop because they were afraid it was going to destroy their ability to sell wheat to Europe, for example, and other very high value markets.
And when exactly did this happen? This is in the early 2000s?
Yeah, the GM wheat controversy happened in the early 2000s. I believe Monsanto officially pulled the plug on this project in 2004. So yeah, it was really in sort of those 3 or 4 years between 2000 and 2004 when this was a really hot topic here on the Canadian prairies.
And that's really interesting to see how this project came out of that, because hearing that that's where you started and then thinking about how the book works, it's as though you sort of went backwards in time to sort of work out the long historical and social developments that led to that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The more I learned about the Canadian Wheat Board and its role in the Canadian wheat economy, the more interested I became in the history of that institution and the way it served to connect the wheat producing region of Canada to other parts of the world, going all the way back to the time of the European settlement of the area.
Indeed. And I think this is a great moment to transition to a sort of broad historical narrative. If you wouldn't mind, if you could spell out the what you see as the major stages in the historical development of this. We'll keep it fairly brief at this point. Give us some key dates, and then we can come back in and fill in each of these stages of development. So where does the story really begin for you?
Sure. Well, I start the story off by talking about the European settlement of the prairie region. There's, of course, an important history of colonization, of dispossession and displacement of indigenous peoples, that it was a precursor to or a condition for that settlement. But it's not something that I get into in the book. If we pick up the story around the 1870s, Canada has just become a confederation, a new country with several provinces. And its population base is in eastern Canada. But there's this notion from the beginning that Canada needs to expand westward and incorporate what was then called the Northwest Territories into the country, and that they would open this region up for wheat production specifically and other natural resource development, I suppose, in order to create a national economy. So it's a project of national economic and social development. And so there was, a whole political process for bringing these territories into the country. And then there was a great deal of effort and political capital spent on designing an immigration program that would bring European settlers, for the most part, to the prairie region to start breaking the soil, to start planting the wheat crops, and turn this into a wheat exporting region. That process was...
Can I ask one quick question just about geographical locations here? How do we define the prairies geographically? For those of our listeners who might not be super familiar with Canadian geography.
Yeah, for sure. We're talking about the region between the Rocky Mountains to the west and almost all the way to the border of Ontario, let's say, in the east, where you start getting into the Canadian Shield and boreal forest. So there's a very, very large region between those western and eastern boundaries that was native prairie, so few trees, a very important ecosystem actually, but native prairie. And also very important to that ecosystem originally was the bison herd, which was numbered in many millions, that were the grazers, right? So and of course the indigenous people, they depended on the bison and its seasonal movements for their own livelihoods.
All right. Okay. So we've got our space, we've got our initial time. So we've got this project of national development very much to incorporate this particular geographic region into the broader Canadian, nation and political economy. Okay. All right, let's continue. So how does this work out then in the 1880s, 1890s, and 1900s?
Yeah, well, initially this was a very, very difficult thing to convince people to come to this pretty remote part of the world. You know, it's a cold climate. The winters get extremely cold, long winter season and so on. And there was, you know, really not much infrastructure or anything, of course, out here, very little European settlement. So it was hard to convince people to come. And to make matters worse, in the 1870s, there was, a large scale international depression, and wheat prices were low and so on and so forth. So that made things really, really difficult. It's not until about the 1890s, the mid-1890s, that you start seeing a real surge in immigration to the area. And that's partly because the world economy improves, because wheat prices improve, and so on. And then between the mid-1890s to, you know, the next two decades, you see a very, very rapid influx of European settlers and others from settlers from the U.S. or from Eastern Canada to the region, and really an explosion in the number of farms, a huge increase in the amount of wheat produced and eventually exported as well. So I would say it's in those two decades that this really takes off. And by, you know, the time that First World War rolls around, you have widespread settlement, tens of thousands of small family farms, and you're producing and exporting a couple of million tons of wheat every year.
And then the First World War really is the beginning of a major period of transition. And you identify 1914 to 1945 as a kind of a period of crisis and flux between this first UK-centered food regime. And we'll come back to the idea of food regime in a moment. Mm-hmm. But we have this first regime, 1870 to 1914, a period of transition, 1914 to 45. And then after the Second World War is over, we get a more stable food regime, again, a second one, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. You know,
can you tell us a little bit about the period of crisis caused by the two wars?
Yeah, certainly. There's so many things are happening at once. But on the one hand, it's kind of a signal that the UK's dominance in the world order is being challenged, and ultimately it gets replaced in a certain sense by the US. By the end of the Second World War. And in terms of kind of world markets and international trade, it's a period of great disturbance and kind of chaos and confusion. Starting in the 1920s, well, the wars are, of course, a huge disruption to international trade, and countries have to find a sort of creative way to make sure those wheat shipments are still happening, because at this moment, the UK has become very heavily dependent on imported wheat as a major part of the national diet, even in calorie terms. The UK was absolutely dependent on these imports of wheat. So there had to be a way to figure out how to keep those wheat shipments moving. And there's some interesting history there, which we could get into later, perhaps. But then, between the wars with the Great Depression, this causes another huge shock to the international system and to international trade for wheat. In the 1920s, at the end of the 20s, the international price for wheat is basically in free fall. This is a big crisis for this, you know, new population of wheat producers on the prairies who are very, very heavily dependent on the price of wheat for their income and their well-being. And farmers' movements and governments in Canada are kind of scrambling to find a way to stabilize farm incomes, to address the crash in the price of wheat, to figure out a way to keep moving that wheat crop, which, you know, you're growing every year, no matter what the price is, into international markets so that the whole wheat economy doesn't collapse. Then, you know, with the Second World War, it's kind of a reprise in some ways of what came with the First World War and all of the disruption of maritime trade and so on. Ultimately, what's really interesting for me in this study is that it's during the Second World War, towards the end of that conflict, that Canada finally settles on this system of single desk wheat marketing, which essentially means farmers will be compelled to deliver their wheat to the Canadian Wheat Board. Then the Wheat Board will sell that wheat on their behalf and return all of the proceeds back to farmers. That sort of highly government coordinated marketing system comes out of the experience of the Second World War and is in place for the next quite a long time. Well, you know, if we look at the dismantling of the wheat board in 2012, so from the early 40s to 2012, that's nearly 70 years.
And the Canadian wheat board is absolutely central to the second phase, the second sort of stable food regime that you describe in the book, which I believe you call the, is it the mercantile industrial?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. It's very interesting because the Canadian wheat board is, it's got its own history. It's unique in certain ways, but it was typical in other ways of how governments of industrialized countries responded to the Depression and the war. They basically set up different mechanisms of government control or coordination over agriculture. And so the wheat board was the way that Canada did this. And it did become extremely important for the next few decades. It was essentially the institution or the agency that connected those wheat producers to world markets. And it was very popular with farmers to have this agency in place because the wheat board was able to overall stabilize wheat prices, offer a minimum wheat price, so provide a bit of price protection for farmers. And the idea was that selling wheat collectively through a single agency was better than having farmers compete against one another, essentially as sellers of wheat. If there's only one place where you can get Canadian wheat and it's through the Canadian Wheat Board, as an international customer, you've got to negotiate with that agency, which has a lot of marketing power, a lot of commercial power, just given the sheer size and volume of the crop that it is handling. It became sort of a one-stop shop for international customers of Canadian wheat.
And of course, at any moment that we consider Canadian wheat, we also have to consider the global markets for that, or in the case of this particular work, the market in the United Kingdom. But that's really in flux, is really shifting somewhat in the post-war period. Can you tell us about where Canadian wheat is going and what the sort of dominant global forces are in this second stable food regime?
Yeah, you're quite right. And just to go back to the first regime for just a moment. I mean, that was very much driven by the UK's need for imports. It was this industrial powerhouse. It was this trading powerhouse. And yet it quite deliberately chose to sacrifice its own agricultural production for cheap imports. And that was sort of a reflection of its power in the world market. It could import these massive volumes of wheat and meat from other places to feed its working classes. And then that allowed it to focus its attention on industrial production and exports. So that was a strategy by the UK. And essentially, it was the reason for being of the prairie wheat economy was to service this huge UK import market. So Canada became very dependent on exports to Europe, but the UK specifically. And that whole strategy on behalf of the UK was called into question with the Second World War. You know, with the huge disruption caused by the war, government leaders became acutely aware that import dependence was a risky strategy and that it made them vulnerable. So after the Second World War, the UK kind of abandoned that to a certain degree and started to focus more on its own agricultural production. So it started to restrict imports and to erect tariffs and those sorts of things to encourage its own domestic agricultural production. And that was going to affect Canada's exports quite dramatically. And the other thing that happened that was quite interesting at this time was that the UK, using public money, developed some new baking technology that actually changed the requirements for wheat for its huge milling and baking industry. Essentially, they were able to develop a technology that made it less important for them to import the same quantities of Canadian wheat, and it allowed them to use more of their own domestically grown wheat, which was, again, sort of a strategy of import substitution. So with that, you see, you know, over the decades from about the 50s to the 80s, quite a precipitous decline in UK imports of Canadian wheat.
And what's the role of the United States in well, not so much the role, but how does the United States as a major producer of wheat in the post-war period, how does that affect Canada's role as a major exporter of wheat as well?
Yeah, that post-war period is super interesting for Canada-US relationships, especially around wheat. You're quite right. The US comes back after the Second World War as a major producer and exporter of wheat. They had kind of eased off of wheat exports in the sort of interwar period in the early 1900s. But they come back after the Second World War with this huge capacity to produce all kinds of agricultural commodities, but wheat included. And that means that Canada and the US are competitors. Now, the interesting thing about this period is that Canada, the kind of wheat that Canada is producing, which is a hard red spring wheat, is very, very highly valued in the international market. Essentially, it's the best quality wheat that you can get for industrial bread production, and customers are willing to pay a premium for that wheat. The U.S. at this time is not really able to compete directly with Canada in that high quality segment of the wheat market. So the two countries essentially work out this cooperative arrangement where they are basically coordinating their price setting behavior. And what happens is that every day the Canadian Wheat Board publishes the price of wheat publicly. It announces it. And then the U.S. would basically set its own wheat prices as a certain discount compared to the Canadian wheat. So Canada was allowed to play this role in sort of setting the international price of wheat, and then the U.S. would kind of set its discount based on Canada's actions. So this gave Canada quite a lot of influence in the international wheat market, and the U.S. went along with this, kind of tolerated this, because it knew it couldn't directly compete with Canada in that high-quality wheat segment. That kind of arrangement lasted until well into the 1960s, but then it sort of started to fall apart in the mid-60s and beyond.
So we'll come to the disintegration of that arrangement in the early 1970s, but let me ask one question first. It might be a little much for me to expect you to have these figures.
Yeah.
But could you give an indication of the relative size of the American and Canadian wheat export?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have those numbers at my fingertips, but I know that you know, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and so on, Canada was a much larger exporter of wheat than the U.S. If I'm not mistaken, I think they accounted for up to, you know, 30-40% of the international wheat trade some years, and that was quite a bit higher than the U.S. Then things start to kind of even out a little bit more in terms of share of the world market. So I wouldn't be surprised if during the 50s, 60s, and so on, the U.S. and Canada are quite close in their export share. But the other interesting thing about that period is that the two countries and other exporters kind of carved the world market up in this very unusual way. The U.S., after the Second World War, starts a food aid program where it basically sells wheat at a heavily discounted price to certain third world countries that are considered important strategic allies. And it allows those countries to pay for U.S. wheat using their local currency, which is a big benefit to those countries as well. So they are using this as a way to dispose of huge wheat surpluses and wheat stocks, and also to kind of build a customer base in these developing countries. Now, because the U.S. is doing this with food aid, that sort of cuts Canada out of the market for those same third world countries. Canada simply can't compete with the food aid that the U.S. is providing. However, what Canada does in response is that it starts to work out these very large commercial wheat exporting deals with communist countries such as the Soviet Union and China. At the time, of course, the U.S. has imposed an embargo on trading with communist countries. So this is seen by Canada as a way to develop its own export markets and deal with its own wheat surpluses, or you know, make sales in a part of the world wheat system, let's say, that the U.S. is not going to touch. So there's this interesting implicit agreement between the U.S. and Canada to carve up the world market in this way. And as I explained in the book, that's relatively stable for about 2 to 2.5 decades.
But it really comes apart in, I believe, 1972, with the beginning of American wheat sales to the Soviet Union.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, very, very famously in the history of the world wheat trade, 1972 is this year that the Soviet Union is basically desperate for a huge quantity of wheat because I believe it's because of a crop failure in its own sort of orbit of Soviet allies. And yes, this is the moment when the U.S. finally breaks that embargo and agrees to ships, you know, several million tons of wheat and other commodities, I believe, as well, to the USSR. And what that does effectively is it, in, you know, very short order, in the space of a few months, it basically clears the surplus hanging over the commercial wheat market, which means that prices dramatically rise for all sorts of food commodities. Some people refer to this as the first world food crisis because of the really rapid spike in food prices. And so in the kind of tradition I'm working in, the food regime's tradition, this is seen as a turning point where the whole structure of the world wheat market basically changes very, very rapidly.
And that leads to then this second period of transition from the early 1970s through, if I recall, into the mid-90s, when you start to get a more stable regime reemerging?
Yeah, there's some debates about that with the experts in this field. But yeah, I think it makes sense to date that transition period from 1972 to 1995, when the World Trade Organization is created.
And how then is the period since 1995, to what extent does it constitute a third sort of stable food regime?
Well, there's a debate and disagreement about that as well. But I'll give you sort of the rough outline of the argument for saying that this is a new food regime. So first of all, the creation of the World Trade Organization is a very significant moment because this is a body that will regulate world trade for the vast majority of the world's countries. And it has a mandate to liberalize trade, to bring in a form of free trade or negotiated free trade among the signatories to the WTO. And for the first time in about 60 years, agriculture is to be incorporated into these negotiations for a kind of free trade regime that applies to all of these countries. Now, between the 1940s and the 1990s, agriculture had specifically been excluded by the request of the U.S. from the GATT, which was what preceded the WTO. And it was kind of common sense, or it was sort of implicitly understood, that agriculture was a special sector, that governments had a legitimate role in regulating that sector, and that it should not be a part of these free trade negotiations. So all that changes with the WTO in 1995. And so I think it is a very important watershed. And it's kind of the beginning of what some people have called the corporate food regime. So what's so different now is that this idea of free trade or trade liberalization becomes the new common sense. And the idea is that we need to open up the international market to more trade. We need to dismantle government supports to agriculture. You know, we need to get rid of institutions like the Canadian Wheat Board. Certainly that's an argument coming from some quarters and so on. So again, a new set of sort of understandings about how the world food trade should be organized. And of course, the other really significant thing is that food corporations and farm input corporations like the chemical manufacturers and the seed companies and so on have at this point become hugely important to that world food system. In fact, these become very powerful transnational corporations that have developed networks of production and distribution and sale really all around the world. So in a certain sense, then the third food regime is one where these corporate interests are becoming much more influential over the way that that international food trade works compared to the post-war period and, you know, well into the 1970s and 80s when it was governments and public institutions that were the most important.
Ah, okay, so we have then three main food regimes, a UK-centered one in the late 19th century up until World War I, a period of transition through the two world wars, a post-war mercantile industrial food regime from 1945 until the early 1970s, a second period of transition until the 1990s, and then the corporate, or I believe in the book you call it the corporate environmental food regime that has existed roughly with qualifications
yes.
since then. Can we consider the theoretical and methodological foundation of this study, which is the idea of a food regime
sure.
itself? Can you tell us about that and how that has helped you understand this really long-term and multifaceted process?
Sure. This approach to kind of the political economy of agriculture came out of a couple of different strands of theory. On the one hand, world systems theory, which looks at the history of capitalism over a very long period of time and understands capitalism as fundamentally a system, an international system that has always incorporated numerous different states or countries and an international division of labor. So what's distinctive about world systems theory, its approach to capitalism, is that it doesn't it disagrees with the idea that you can identify capitalism in one country. So for the world systems thinkers, capitalism is by nature an international system with an international division of labor. One of the ideas coming out of that line of thinking was the notion of a hegemonic power at different moments in capitalist history. So the hegemonic power is a leading state power, a leading country that is economically and politically dominant for a certain period of time. And with that, the power that comes with that role allows it to, in a certain sense, set some of the rules of the international order and of the international capitalist economy. So that's a very brief look at world systems theory. Then some of the other influences on food regimes were regulation theory coming out of France, which is another way of kind of periodizing capitalism, if you will, and looking at different modes of production and regulation of capitalism at different periods. And what the kind of pioneers of food regimes theory did, they were Harriet Friedman and Philip McMichael, was take some of these ideas and start to think about how you could connect the history of capitalism over the long term to the international production and distribution and consumption of food. Now, obviously, food is absolutely fundamental to our societies. It's fundamental to social reproduction, and it's fundamental to capitalism in the sense that, of course, workers need to eat. Well, everyone needs to eat. But the price of food and how it gets produced and distributed is fundamentally important to harnessing that labor power into the capitalist mode of production. So Friedman and McMichael wrote this very influential paper in 1989 that lays this out for the first time. And they essentially propose that if we look at capitalist history since about the 1870s, we can identify, at that time, they were talking about two food regimes, which were basically periods where you had a certain stability in the rules of engagement and the structures in place for this international food system. And it lasted basically as long as the hegemonic power lasted as well. So in the, you know, in the late 19th century, it was the UK with its sort of free trade philosophy and policy, which fundamentally reshaped the way that food production and distribution happened, right? It's because the UK adopted a policy of free trade and stopped protecting its domestic farmers that it created this massive demand for wheat and meat and other products. And that fundamentally transformed different parts of the world, like Canada, the US, and Australia, which stepped in to produce those products and pump them into the international trade. So this was the idea, right, behind the food regime thesis, was that looking back at history, you can identify these periods where hegemonic power kind of shaped the whole, all of the arrangements of the of food production, distribution, and consumption on a very large scale.
And one thing that I really appreciate about the food regime is the way that it helps you bring into conversation multiple groups or interests or actors. And so you'll frequently, in the book, you'll be discussing the Canadian prairies, and you'll note, say, the importance of the farmers as a productive unit in the family farm, but also as social movements that will push for certain political changes, the role of the Canadian government in regulating this, the role of things like transportation infrastructure. And then on the other hand, we have, say, the role of the British government, the British milling and baking industries, and British consumers. And I really appreciate the way that the food regime, you know, provides a language and a framework to pull all of these diverse actors together.
Yeah, I think that's very important, right? You know, one of the criticisms of the food regime's approach at times has been that it's kind of too structuralist, that it's a bit deterministic and so on. And I think there's been some work in the last 20 years or so to try and correct that. But you're quite right. The idea is that, you know, a food regime is not just it's not just an abstraction. It's actually a set of relationships and rules and even frames of understanding, frames of reference that guide people's behavior. And it does make sense to think about these different groups. Sometimes they're class interests, like farmers versus, you know, the owners of the grain elevators and the railways, but also states or governments, and social movements as well. There's not, you know, farmers do and have acted as a social movement at times, but consumers also have organized themselves into social movements in ways that can then have a major influence on the way that these international food relationships work.
Now, you mentioned earlier that it's kind of a way to help periodize capitalism. And I found that, yes, really effective in the book, because at so many points, you'll discuss a certain food regime or a transitional period, and you'll really effectively, I think, show how developments that within each of these phases of time, there are contradictions, and that, yes, the attempt to manage and handle these contradictions often then helps set the stage for and you know, lead into the next phase. And so one way to see that, for example, is looking at, in the late 19th century, the particular problems that Canadian prairie farmers faced and how the Canadian government, even before World War I, was moving in a direction of more regulation in the grain trade. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, exactly. Farmers were, you know, is very interesting. They were very vulnerable in a certain way. They're, you know, small scale farmers with a little bit of land producing, you know, one crop of commercial importance. There were crop rotations and so on, but wheat was really the linchpin of this whole agricultural economy. And so they were extremely dependent on the price of wheat. They were dependent on export markets. And they were also dependent on the grain elevators, which, you know, is where the farmer takes their grain to be delivered and then shipped out of the region. The prairies is really, you know, the region is far from everything. It was quite isolated. And so you had to get that wheat to market by train. And that often meant shipping at a distance of some 1,500 to 2,000 kilometers, right? So a very long way. So in some ways, farmers are quite dependent on these other actors in the grain trade. But the one thing they do have is numbers. And certainly in the early prairie wheat economy, they're also very politically influential because they are most of the population. And the whole, you know, project of developing this region as a part of Canada depends on the success of the wheat economy. So what you start seeing in the even the late 1800s and into the early 1900s is farmers getting organized, forming associations or farmers unions, and then lobbying or pressing the government for regulations that will protect them from the private interests of the trade. So I think it's very early on, it's around 1912 or so, that the Canadian government brings in the Canada Grain Act, which is a law is quite wide ranging in its regulation of the grain trade, but it puts in place some really important protections for farmers, and especially at the point when they're dealing with the grain elevators. For instance, it protects them in terms of how their grain gets graded. It allows for independent testing of their grain so that the elevator agent isn't cheating them, for example, telling them it's a number two hard wheat when actually it's a number one hard wheat that would fetch a much higher price. There's regulations on weighing the grain to make sure that the elevator agent isn't messing around with the scales and shortchanging farmers. So it's interesting to me that the government at this point is quite prepared to put in place regulations that protect this very important political class, the farmers, from the powerful private interests of the grain trade.
Is it fair to say that the goal of the Canadian government at this point, just before World War I, is to respond to the political pressure of these farmers' movements and to basically ensure maybe a minimum income or a minimum price or minimum viability for the prairie farm economy?
Yeah, I mean, that comes a bit later. Originally the governments are quite hesitant to interfere in the marketing or selling of wheat. So they're prepared to regulate the trade, make sure that farmers are treated fairly at the grain elevator and so on, but they're quite wary of interfering in the market itself. And where that changes is with World War I, actually, and the first time the government experiments with a kind of government-based marketing or selling of grain is in 1920, after the end of the First World War, when the international wheat market was so chaotic that the government felt it had to step in and basically collect wheat on behalf of farmers and take charge of selling that wheat so that farmers would get paid the best price that could be realized in the world market. So it's an interesting moment because it's a kind of an experiment that the government undertakes, and farmers are quite pleased with this, right? They have a bit more certainty and a bit more stability. One of the things that farmers were very very frustrated with was that, of course, given the seasonal nature of wheat production, everybody is looking to sell their wheat at the same time. So there's a big glut of wheat in the fall, and farmers found that if they really needed to sell that wheat right away, the price was always much lower in the fall when the elevators knew that there were there was just a glut of wheat on the market. So farmers felt very sort of dependent on that, and depending on the whether or not they could withhold some grain and sell it a bit later had a huge effect on the price that they got. Well, with this first wheat board that was brought in by the government after the end of World War I, that was no longer the case. The government basically said, we are fixing a minimum price. We will collect all the wheat and we'll sell it over the course of a period of months. And then we will return whatever proceeds over and above that minimum price back to you, the farmer. So farmers get stability and predictability, which is something that they're really after.
And this is really tied closely to the notion of quality that you discuss in the text, and how Canadian wheat earns a certain reputation for quality in the late 19th century, and that has profound effects on the whole trajectory of prairie wheat. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Yeah, that's another very important piece. From early on, wheat buyers recognized that Canadian wheat has this special quality, which is basically it's got a higher protein content than just than wheat that, that you can grow just about anywhere else. And so the government and the wheat industry is very interested on kind of capitalizing on that in order to get fetch a better price for their wheat and develop markets for Canadian wheat. So quite early on, and I believe it's in the 1920s and 30s, the government is already implementing certain rules about introducing new wheat varieties. So basically, anyone who wants to develop a new wheat variety and introduce it into the system has to prove that that wheat is superior to what already exists, and specifically superior in terms of quality, yield, and so on and so forth. And if for any reason it's, you know, found to be not a benefit, a net benefit to farmers, the government won't allow it to be introduced. So in that way, the government is kind of taking a hand in ensuring that quality of the wheat crop. And this becomes kind of the brand for Canadian wheat, which is this high quality, high protein wheat that is really well suited to industrial bread production.
Now, how does, so we've mentioned before that the Canadian prairies are, you know, linked in this food regime to especially British consumers. How do British bread preferences and baking techniques and milling techniques play into this notion of quality, and how does that change over the, especially the middle of the 20th century?
There's a really interesting history there. Starting in the late 1800s, the UK starts adopting a new technology called steel roller milling. So these are huge industrial plants that will turn that grain into flour. But the process is very different from the older technology, which was stone milling, in that it flattens the grain of wheat and allows for a very easy separation of the bran from the wheat germ, from and the other part of the wheat kernel. And so stone milling allows you to produce a very white flour and to take out, unfortunately, take out all of the nutrients that are found in the wheat germ and in the bran.
Roller and milling that really,
Pardon me?
Roller milling does that, right? Stone milling is...
That's right. Yeah. And so what starts happening around this time is that consumers start really, really preferring white bread that is produced with this new type of flour to anything else. And it's an interesting kind of historical story because at one time, white bread was considered something that was... well, it was more expensive and it was associated with sort of higher class consumers. And so once white flour and white bread become a lot cheaper and more accessible, well, you know, that really catches on and everybody wants to be eating this sort of new industrial white bread. And that, of course, that is something that drives demand for Canadian wheat, which is ideally suited for this particular kind of processing technology. So what you find is a rapid shift over to white bread. And in fact, there's even this movement in the early 1900s in the UK where consumers are lobbying the government not to restrict imports of wheat from abroad because they've come to depend on this cheap white loaf. This becomes kind of their rallying cry, is they want to keep bread cheap. And that depends on keeping the market open to North American wheat. What happens a little bit later during the World Wars is because of the shortages of wheat at the time, the government actually imposes a rule where millers have to, rather than producing white wheat where all the nutrients have been, or many of the important nutrients have been extracted, they require the millers to produce brown flour, which is that much more nutritious. So it's sort of the notion is that the government is rationing the nutrients in the wheat grain by forcing the millers and processors to keep those nutrients in the flour. And so wartime bread is brown bread, which people don't like.
No, not at all. No, and it has a much higher extraction rate. So the way the millers describe that is through how much of the grain, or how much of the sort of total mass of the grain is extracted in the milling process. And I found it remarkable how you noted that before World War I, the normal extraction rate was, I think, about 70 or 71%. So you run a certain quantity of wheat through a mill, 70-ish percent of that comes out as flour. But during the war, they bump it up to 80-some percent. And eventually, by the end of the war, it's over 90%, which must have been a very brown loaf indeed.
Yeah, exactly. It's very close to sort of 100% whole wheat bread. But yeah, I found that a really fascinating example of government intervention to regulate the nutritional quality of this really important food staple for people. But, you know, as a result of that, people sort of came to resent wartime bread or war bread. And as soon as those wartime controls were lifted in the late 40s, people went straight back to buying white bread from their local bakers and grocery stores and so on. And what the bread industry did, because the government was concerned about the nutritional quality of this bread, is the industry essentially brought in artificial fortification of bread. So, and again, this was a new technology, but they found ways to reintroduce some of those missing nutrients like iron and B vitamins back into the bread supply through artificial means, so that people could go on consuming their loaves of white bread.
And so that, to some extent, would you say that represents a redefinition of quality in this, I guess that would be in the second stable food regime, that has then a different definition of quality from the first one?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's very typical of that post-war period where there's a huge amount of innovation in the food processing and food manufacturing sector. You get all kinds of new products, all sorts of new frozen foods and processed foods and so on. It's sort of the heyday of that highly processed food. It's well before people start looking at the ingredient list in detail to look at the different preservatives and additives and so on and so forth. And indeed, these new products are associated with convenience and modernity and other values that are very common, very popular at this time, that sort of post-war optimism. So I don't think, you know, there's not much of a backlash against this fortified bread. In a sense, you know, it's the heyday of Wonder Bread in North America. That same sort of phenomenon is happening over in the UK as well.
And then how has the definition of quality continued to evolve, especially in the period of transition from the 1970s or in the sort of final food regime that you described from the 1990s on?
Yeah, the thinking is that in the third food regime from the 1990s on, one of the driving forces for change is greater consumer awareness of nutrition and health and so on and so forth. So you get people becoming more aware, better educated in many cases of what goes into their food, and demanding fewer additives, fewer preservatives, you know, a shorter ingredient list, more natural ingredients and so on. And of course, you have to be careful here. I mean, it's sort of a certain class segment of the market that becomes hyper aware of food quality. And it's not everyone who can afford to look for those higher quality and often more expensive foods. But this does become a motor force, I think, for changes. And food industries respond by introducing, more products and sort of a product differentiation strategy, where you might have, a really expensive loaf of bread on the one hand, you know, $4 a loaf or more in cases, and then your rock bottom basic white loaf of bread for $2 or something like that. So you get a differentiation of the market.
And the term that you used in the book that I found fascinating, it's a terrific term, is premiumization.
Yeah, and specifically in the UK bread market, what's happening in the 1980s is there's kind of a price war among the big bread manufacturers. And at this point, we're still talking about your basic white bread, but you know, people are selling it so cheaply as a loss leader to get people through the supermarket door. There's this crazy story I came across at one point in my research of farmers in the UK buying bread off the shelves in huge quantities and feeding it to their sheep because the loaves were so cheap. It was actually cheaper than buying feed for those animals. So, you know, in the 80s, this sort of thing was a huge concern to food manufacturers. And there's this company named Warburton's that comes along. It's a sort of a regional bread manufacturer in the 1980s. And they say, hey, wait a minute. You know, we think there's a market for higher quality bread product that we can sell for a lot more. And maybe that's a way out of this kind of race to the bottom for the regular bread market. So they started developing this strategy in the 1980s and into the 90s. And they are the ones who, I've argued, kind of lead the premiumization of the bread market in the UK. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone's all of a sudden buying this more expensive bread, but it's a successful enough strategy that, like, as I said before, on the same, you know, supermarket shelf, you have a huge range of different products at different price points, and some people are prepared to pay more for what they consider to be a higher quality product. In some cases, maybe a more nutritious product or a more environmentally friendly product. And Warburton's really capitalizes on that trend.
The story of feeding sheep that the store-bought bread is absolutely terrific. It's wonderful. And I think
it's by far the weirdest bit of information I came across.
Definitely. And I think it's a good way into a final segment here. I'd like to talk about the research process and how you approach this particular topic, and, you know, where you turned for your data.
Sure. Well, it was a pretty sort of multifaceted research process, I would say. On the one hand, I was digging through historical statistics. Often, you know, these were kept very meticulously by either Canadian government officials or British government officials. So some of those things were really helpful. I read a lot of the kind of secondary historical literature on the UK food market, the food industry, the bread industry specifically. Same goes for the Canadian wheat economy. There's a huge historical literature around this, and certainly in the even as far back as the 20s, 30s, and 40s, people were writing pretty detailed studies of how this whole process of developing the wheat economy had come about. I looked at historical materials of the Canadian Wheat Board, and these were often very well kind of preserved and organized as well. So I was able to go back to records for the Wheat Board that went quite a ways back, and lots of interesting kind of internal documents for that organization. Government reports were an important part of the source material as well. The wheat economy has been kind of a perennial, you know, big policy question on the prairies. So every so often you'd get a government commission or royal commission or a new report, and those were often really helpful in understanding what was happening at that time and you know, how it affected all the different players. And then the last thing I would mention is that I did quite a few interviews with grain industry actors in Canada. I was able to interview some of the officials with Warburton's from the UK, because they actually would come to Canada every year to test the wheat quality. And thankfully, the Canadian Wheat Board was very gracious in allowing me to interview a number of their officials, and they were able to give me a really good sort of insider's look at how that organization worked.
Well, that is terrific. Can you, by way of closing, would you care to tell us what you're working on now? Any new projects you have lined up, or you know, maybe already simmering away?
Sure. Well, I'm still interested in this whole question of wheat marketing and wheat selling and so on. The wheat board has been gone now for just about 6 years, so I'm interested in how that's affecting prairie farmers. But mostly my research these days is on investor ownership and investor purchases of farmland. So there's this area in my field where people are looking into what's called the financialization of agriculture, basically the way in which new investors are pouring money into things like farmland or other parts of the agricultural value chain. And my interest is in how that could be affecting farmers and rural communities.
Terrific. Well, we look forward to hearing much more from you in the future. Andre Magnin, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure. I really enjoyed the book and I had a great time talking.
Thanks so much.